Well, good morning, everyone. So, January 15th, 2007. That date ring a bell to anyone other than myself? That was my actual official start date here in 2007. Hi, Haley. How are you? Just pop in random doors? Just pop in random doors for us? Thanks. Yeah, January 15th. So, that means I am finishing up my 19th year. And that also means that, Lord willing, January 15th, 2026 would be the start of my 20th year. And so if it's all right with you guys, I think I'll shoot for it. Is that all right? So last weekend, for those of you that were here, my family, actually, half of my family is rarely here because my kids are both away at school. Denise's birthday was last Saturday. It was her 50th. She's downstairs. She's not going to know unless you guys tell on me. And Sunday was my 59th, which if you do the math real quick, yes, I'm 9 years older than her and all that. People ask how we met. I always start the story the same way. I was the youth pastor at the church. And everybody goes, uh-oh. And I said, I was 30. She was 21 and got hired onto the same staff. And all of a sudden, everybody's, okay. Yeah, so it's okay that way. So anyway, we decided of different options to celebrate our birthdays, to spend the weekend in Detroit, Michigan. Now, you may involuntarily react to Detroit, Michigan. No offense to Detroit, Michigan. And say, why would you spend your birthday weekend in Detroit, Michigan? Because that's where my kid was. So not only did we spend the weekend in Detroit, Michigan, we spent the entire weekend in a bowling alley in Detroit, Michigan. All day Saturday, all day Sunday. We rolled into Detroit, Michigan about 1 a.m. Saturday morning after being in a wedding in Lafayette on Friday. And then we rolled in here Sunday night about, I don't know, 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. So I share all that to say Detroit, Michigan was a means to an end for us. Detroit, Michigan was a means to an end of supporting and caring for and loving our kid to go and support and show and be with them, who, by the way, is about 35 minutes away from here this morning at a bowling alley on the west side of Indianapolis. And so when this service is over, Denise and I are going to scoot really, really quick to try to get there by the time the end of the bowling tournament starts. And just so you know, right before I came up on the platform, he had just thrown a strike. So I know that because I saw it on the live stream. So Detroit, Michigan was a means to an end. The means part of a means to an end is oftentimes something that we don't look at as desirable or preferable. It's what we have to do to achieve what we really want to do. The end, the goal, the result. For some people, for my maternal grandfather, he worked for years and years and years at the Chrysler Foundry in Indianapolis. And for a long part of his time at that job was a means to an end. It was not something he enjoyed. It was not something he looked forward to. He got up every day and went to work for the purpose of providing for his family, to put food on the table. His job was literally a means to an end for him. Students study. Not because they enjoy studying or want to study. Sometimes it depends. They don't even enjoy the content that they're studying. They're studying to pass the test to get a good grade. It's simply a means to an end. Sometimes when it comes to relationship with God, we apply this means to an end mentality to relationship with God. That God works in us to work through us to accomplish something as a result of us. And sometimes those things are skewed in our perspective to the point that we believe we are a means to an end for God. That the reason God works in us is to work through us. The real reason God works in us is to transform us, because He deeply loves us and deeply cares for us and deeply wants what's best for us. God does work in us to work through us. But God works through us because the world is broken by sin, and He deeply loves the world and humankind and desires what's best for them. And He wants to work in us to transform us, to work through us, to transform the world and invite people to follow Jesus. We often take a means to an end approach and say, well, we are just pawns in God's grand game. That we are merely being used by God to accomplish His purpose. I do not believe that we should ever say we are merely being used by God to accomplish His purposes. I believe the more accurate perception is that we have the grand privilege of being partners with God in His grand plan to redeem and restore a world that was broken by sin. We are not merely being used by God. We are not a means to an end for God, because God deeply loves us, deeply cares for us, and deeply wants what's best for us. God works in us to work through us, to accomplish His purposes, and those purposes include the transformation of our lives. When Paul wrote to the first century church in Philippi, he wrote to them and addresses this means to an end perspective a little bit to convince them that they are not merely a means to an end for God. They are not merely a means to an end for Paul, that there is a grander picture and a grander story being written by God. And he writes to them, he says, "Dear friends, you always followed my instructions when I was with you, and now that I am away, it is even more important." The short version of what Paul is saying here is, just because I am no longer physically present with you does not mean that the work we were doing together while I was with you should stop. He's saying, don't just follow my instructions when I'm with you. Don't just follow my instructions because I'm with you. Whether I'm with you or not, continue to follow my instructions. At the time that Paul wrote this, he was in a Roman prison, wrongly arrested and waiting trial before Caesar for simply sharing the good news of Jesus. As he shared the good news of Jesus, it offended some of the Jewish religious leaders, and they plotted and schemed to have him arrested and were going to have to try to have him killed, and he appealed to Caesar. So he's in a Roman prison writing to them saying, even though I am in a Roman prison, even though I am in prison for doing the very thing that I'm telling you you should do and the very work that we started together there in Philippi, keep doing it. Don't do it just because I'm no longer with you, and especially because I'm in prison for doing it. Keep doing it. It is even more important that you continue the work while I'm away. The people in Philippi were a very receptive audience to Paul when he was there, and he built deep and strong relationships with the people there. And it would have been very, very easy for, once Paul was gone and once Paul had been arrested, for them to just slip back into life as it was before Paul introduced them to Jesus. And he's saying, don't let that happen. He's saying, continue to work hard and to follow my instructions. And then he says, work hard to show the results of your salvation, obeying God with deep reverence and fear. If you grew up in church or have spent very much time in church at all, you may have heard this verse translated to continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. That's a very common translation of it. I like the way that the New Living Translation approaches this verse, because it clarifies what we are working out. We are working hard to show the results of our salvation. We are not working for our salvation. the work that Jesus did on the cross is more than sufficient to cover the salvation of all of humankind. And therefore, there is no work that we can do for our salvation. We work to show the results of our salvation. The phrase that's translated work hard there means to work out, to carry out to the goal, to work and complete to its ultimate conclusion, its ultimate completion, its ultimate fulfillment. And so we are not working for our salvation. We are working our salvation out to its full and final completion. And we obey God out of deep reverence and fear. The word there is not a horror show type of fear. It's a deep reverence, a respect, an awe for who God is. I tell my kids all the time that I'm okay with a healthy dose of fear. I'm okay with them stepping back and saying, if I make this decision, what will Dad do? And to have a healthy dose of fear of what Dad is going to do, I'm okay with that. But that healthy dose of fear comes out of who they know me to be and what it is that I desire for them. It isn't, I hope anyway, for them, it isn't a, I better not do this or Dad's going to become completely unglued. I hope that it is more out of who I know my dad to be and the values and convictions that he carries and has tried to instill in me. If I make this decision, he is going to respond out of those values and convictions because of what he wants for me. And I'm okay with a healthy dose of fear. He says, for God is working in you, giving you the desire and the power to do what pleases him. The word that's translated there means to work, it means to energize or influence. So in verse 12, we're told to continue to work, to do the hard work, work hard, and it's you working that accomplishes this. And then in verse 13, he says, for it is God working in you. And so there's this beautiful picture of a partnership. we often hear people in circumstances say, what we need to do right now is we need to just let go and let God. And sometimes that's very wise counsel. Sometimes it's the worst counsel in the world, but sometimes it's very wise counsel. We have to let go and let God. What Paul is saying here is almost we have to take hold with God. Now, we don't take hold with God and try to wrestle control from God, but we take hold with God that God does his part and we do our part to continue to work out this salvation, to show the work of the results of the work that God did in us when Jesus paid the price for our sins. And it is God that gives you the desire and the power to do what pleases him. And so in this beautiful partnership, one commentator says that God is more interested in the workman than the work. Because if the workman is not as he ought to be, the work will not be as it ought to be. And so God works in us to work through us. And it is this beautiful partnership of God being God and us working out what God has done for us and continues to do in us to be able to do through us. Then he says, do everything without complaining and arguing so that no one can criticize you. Every time that my wife and I, my wife, Denise, you guys know her as Denise, every time that Denise and I would tell our kids to do something and they would mumble under their breath, we would say, now God said do nothing without complaining and arguing. Actually, we didn't do that to them because that would have just driven them away from what this verse really means. Do everything without complaining and arguing. The complaining and arguing here is also translated rumblings and murmurings. And it's not the overt, out loud complaining and our. It's not the big squeaky wheel. It's the silent whispers over here in the corner where you want to be heard, but you only want to be heard by the people you want to be heard by because you know they already agree with you. And you know that if you're heard by who you want to be heard by and they already agree with you, you might be able to muster a little bit of momentum towards the end. So they might become a means to the end of whatever it is that you want. Paul may have in view here what the Jewish people did after they left Egypt and spent time wandering in the wilderness. It says very, very, very often that they mumbled and complained. They murmured and they groaned. They became discontent. They became discouraged. And they complained against Moses. But then there was a time where Moses was complaining to God that the people were complaining against him. And God basically told Moses, take it personally. They're not complaining against you. They're complaining against me. And so these murmurings and rumblings, I don't know if you've noticed or not, but murmurs and rumblings almost always generate enough momentum to turn into arguments and disagreements. Almost always. And this is what Paul is saying, that those murmurings and rumblings, you should do everything without that, because that will disrupt the unity of the church. And it will do damage to God's body, and therefore you shouldn't do it. If you do everything without mumbling and complaining, nobody can criticize you. You will never be accused of the person who holds the little side meeting in the room whispering towards your end and doing damage and destruction to the church if you do everything without complaining and arguing. Now, that doesn't mean that we always agree and we never push back and we don't have healthy conversation about things that we don't see eye to eye on. It doesn't mean that. It means not to allow those things to escalate to become disruption. Then he says, live clean, innocent lives as children of God, shining like bright lights in a world full of crooked and perverse people. Living clean, innocent lives does not mean living lives of perfection. It doesn't mean that you never mess up. It doesn't mean that you never miss the mark. What it means is that you are living a clean, innocent life, that you are doing your very best to live the kind of life that God desires you to live, that you are doing your very best to show the results of your salvation to those around you, to the world around you. And that when you miss the mark, you're given the benefit of the doubt because everyone knows you're doing the best that you can and you just simply mess this one up. Instead of going out and being rebellious and defiant, you're living a clean, innocent life as a child of God, shining like bright lights in a world full of crooked and perverse people. The words that are used for crooked and perverse there in the original language means to be distorted, twisted, and wicked. Moses used the same words, the same language for the Jewish people. Jesus and his follower Peter used the same words when they described the condition of the world that had been broken by sin. And notice that when we, as followers of Jesus, live clean, innocent lives as children of God, working out our salvation, showing the results of the work that God has done in us, to the world around us, and through us, that we shine like a bright light in a world full of crooked and perverse people. In a world that is broken by sin, in a world that has been darkened by sin, followers of Jesus who live clean, innocent lives to the best of their ability to show the results of their salvation shine as a light. And when you are in darkness, what do you need to be able to see? Not just clearly, but to see anything, what do you need? You need light. And therefore, a world that is full of crooked and perverse people, a world that has been darkened by sin, what does that world need to see? Light. And Paul says that light comes from followers of Jesus who are living clean, innocent lives. Hold firmly hold firmly to the word of life. Then, on the day of Christ's return, I will be proud that I did not run the race in vain and that my work was not useless. Hold firmly. Take hold of the word of life and let that be what pours in you to pour through you to be a light to the world around you. Paul says to the people at Philippi, with whom he had a very deep relationship and a very strong connection, said, if you do these things, then on the day of Christ's return, I will be proud and I will know that I have not run the race in vain, and the work that I started there and the work that we did together was not useless. He says, but I will rejoice even if I lose my life. And remember, Paul's writing this from a Roman prison, waiting to stand trial before Caesar. He doesn't know whether Caesar will release him, continue to have him imprisoned, or have him put to death. And so he says, even if I lose my life, pouring it out like a liquid offering to God. It was very, very common that when people offered sacrifices, they would pour some kind of liquid on the sacrifice itself. Sometimes it was water, sometimes it was wine, sometimes it was another type of liquid substance. But Paul says, if I lose my life for inviting people to follow Jesus, if I lose my life for sharing the good news about Jesus, I will consider that a pouring out like a liquid sacrifice, a liquid offering to God. Just like your faithful service is an offering to God. And I want all of you to share that joy. Here Paul's writing from a Roman prison, and he's talking about rejoicing. Even if I lose my life, I will rejoice. And even if I lose my life, I want you to share that joy. In circumstances that are less than joyful, in circumstances that are less desirable, in circumstances that may very well have been a means to an end for Paul, he writes about rejoicing and joy. He says, yet you should rejoice. Yes, you should rejoice, and I will share your joy. So now there's a reciprocal thing going on here. I will rejoice, and you share my joy. You rejoice, and I'll share your joy. And maybe the only murmuring and grumbling is who got to share whose joy the most. He says, if the Lord Jesus is willing, I hope to send Timothy. And there's a little bit of a shift in the letter here. He said, if the Lord Jesus is willing, I hope to send Timothy to you soon for a visit. Then he can cheer me up by telling me how you are getting along. Timothy was a young man who had become a protege of Paul's. He had traveled with Paul. He had spent time in Philippi. Timothy was known in Philippi as Paul had spent time there. Timothy traveled to Rome with Paul and was likely sharing in his imprisonment, whether that means Timothy was imprisoned also or he was just there. A lot of the time that Paul was in prison in Rome, he was on what was considered house arrest. And so he was able to stay in his own accommodations, not all the time, but sometime. And so when he was on house arrest, there were likely people that stayed with him and shared in his imprisonment while he was on house arrest. So he says, I hope to send Timothy to you soon. If there was ever a time in Paul's life when he needed the support of someone like Timothy, it would have been when he wrote this letter. It would have been during his imprisonment. But notice what Paul is willing to do. Paul is willing to send Timothy to give them an update on what's going on. Philippi and Rome were about 800 miles apart. And so he's willing to send Timothy 800 miles, which at the time would have taken almost a full month to travel. And so he goes, send him for a visit. And what's he going to do? Then it appears that Timothy is going to, at least at the very least, send word back to Paul to cheer him up, to tell how the Philippians are getting along. It looks like Paul could use a little bit of cheering up at this point, but he's willing to send Timothy. He says, I have no one else like Timothy who genuinely cares about your welfare. The phrase there that's translated "no one else," the Greek language carries the idea of there is no one else like-minded or soul-minded like Timothy. The relationship that they had together was such that they were of the same mind and of the same purpose. And Timothy, or Paul says, "I have no one else like Timothy, who so genuinely cares about your welfare. And I hope to send him back soon so he can tell you what's going on with me and so that he can tell me what's going on with you. And I guarantee you what's going on with you will cheer me up." He said all the others care only for themselves and not what matters to Jesus Christ. And then he goes on. "But you know how Timothy has proved himself." The word "proved" there is someone that has been tested and tried and proven to be genuine as like a fine metal. And whatever this testing has looked like for Timothy, Timothy has been tested and he has proved himself over and over. And the Philippian people knew it. Like a son with his father. That is a very, very powerful statement that Paul is making there because of the father-son relationship in the first century. "He has served with me in preaching the good news." Paul and Timothy were not biologically related. They were not father and son, but the relationship they had developed had become like a son with his father. With the faithfulness of a son to his father, "He has served with me in preaching the good news." And he is saying clearly how much he values Timothy, who he is willing to send back to them when maybe he needed him most, by the way. He said, "I hope to send him to you just as soon as I find out what is going to happen to me here. And I have confidence from the Lord that I myself will come to see you soon. Though there is uncertainty about what Caesar will rule in Paul's case, Paul has a confidence deep down that things are going to work out and Paul will be able to return back to Philippi soon. In the meantime, though Paul would prefer to go to Philippi himself, in the meantime, Timothy is going to serve as a substitute for Paul, as a messenger for Paul, and as an ambassador for Paul back to the people in Philippi. He says, "Meanwhile, I thought I should send Epaphroditus." Epaphroditus was a very common name in the first century culture, but it is clear that Paul has someone specific in mind. He says, "I hope to send Epaphroditus back to you. He is a true brother." The words there literally mean someone of the same womb. So he sees Epaphroditus as a true brother, as a co-worker, which means as a fellow laborer or a companion fully engaged in the work, and a fellow soldier, which means someone fully engaged in the battle. "And he was your messenger to help me in my time of need." Epaphroditus was sent from Philippi to Rome to tend to Paul's needs. As a supporter of the church in Philippi, as a supporter of Paul, the church in Philippi sent Epaphroditus to stay with Paul in Rome for as long as Paul would need him. And he sent word, he carried word from Philippi to Paul about conditions in the church in Philippi. The word, the name Epaphroditus literally means charming. But the way that Paul describes him goes well beyond just simply charming. He is a true brother, a co-worker, and a fellow soldier who he has entrusted with the message. "I am sending him because he has been longing to see you, and he was very distressed that you heard he was ill." So it appears that maybe Epaphroditus might have been a little bit homesick and wanted to go back. He was willing to stay with Paul, but there was this longing to go back and all that. But people had gotten word that he was sick. And so Paul wanted to send him back so that they could see that Epaphroditus was in fact doing okay. It almost seems that maybe Paul was worried that the people of Philippi were worried about Epaphroditus. And Paul didn't want the people of Philippi to be worried. And he didn't want to worry about them being worried. So he decided to send Epaphroditus back so that they wouldn't worry and he wouldn't have to worry that they were worried anymore. Follow that? Need me to say it again? You want me to try? I could do it. And he certainly was ill. In fact, he almost died. But God had mercy on him. One of the things that I found very interesting, and to be honest with you, I'd have blown right past this had it not been for a couple of things I uncovered in some commentaries. But God had mercy on him. The commentators suggest that what this shows in Epaphroditus is that Paul did not have a unilateral ability to heal anyone and everyone. That the times that are recorded where Paul healed people were not incidental. That's you know what I mean by that word. It's not the word that I want to convey, but that not anybody and everybody who came to Paul that was sick, he was able to heal miraculously. It says that by saying God had mercy on him, it appears that Epaphroditus was recovered more naturally or medically, but not by a miraculous prayer or laying on of hands by Paul. So I thought that was fascinating. And also on me, so that I would not have one sorrow after another. So it appears that Epaphroditus had gotten so sick that he almost died, and that God showed mercy and made him well so that he could be sent back to Philippi to encourage them. It's almost like God is working in Epaphroditus to work through Epaphroditus to accomplish his purposes. And he's also showing mercy to Paul to keep Paul from experiencing another loss, another heartbreak, another sorrow. He says, "So I am all the more anxious to send him back to you, for I know you will be glad to see him, and then I will not be so worried about you." So it's almost like Paul is saying, he's worried. No, I'm kidding. I won't do that again. Then he goes on to say, "Welcome him in the Lord's love and with great joy." It's possible that when Epaphroditus goes back to Philippi, there could have been a dark cloud of failure around his return. He went there to serve Paul as long as Paul needed him. And then he got sick. And then he almost died. And then he had to come home. And there could have been almost a sense of failure that Epaphroditus didn't accomplish what he was sent to accomplish. And Paul says, when he comes back, welcome him with the Lord's love and great joy, and give him the honor that people like him deserve. And then go on. "For he risked his life." And the phrase "risked his life" there is a gambling term. And it means that the people in the first century would invoke the name of the goddess Venus, and they would invoke the name of, because she was the goddess of gambling, and they would invoke the name, they would invoke the goddess Venus, the goddess of gambling, with the word Epaphroditus. This person's name. It's almost like there's a fascinating wordplay going on. I'm going to send Epaphroditus back to you, who Epaphroditus his life, to do for me here what you were unable to do because we were 800 miles away. So it's fascinating to me that, you know, When something in our world happens now and a news story gets released, there is almost always a slew of videos from different angles. And I've told you guys before, I watch headlines more than I watch news stories, because news stories tend to be depressing to me. And they have a depressive effect on me. And so I tend to watch more headlines. But there are times where Denise and I will see a story. Denise is my wife, by the way. Denise and I will see a story, and we'll watch this video unfold. And I can't tell you the number of times that we will watch this video and go, why are these people videoing and not helping? Why will they not put their phone down and help this person who's being beaten? Why will they, whatever the situation is. There's a situation not long ago, the Ukrainian lady that was stabbed in the subway or the bus or subway in New York. And if you happen to see any of those videos, the lady got stabbed and people literally got up and walked away. Why was no one willing to help? Why was no one willing to serve? Why, if we can't even put our phones down or wrap our arms around a person who's just been stabbed, imagine how difficult it was in the first century to get someone to travel 800 miles in a culture where concern for others was not considered a virtue. And so when you put what Paul wrote and what we just went through into that context, the radical countercultural message about a means to an end, that God works in us to work through us, not as pawns in some game, but as people who work out the results of their salvation in such a way that shines a light into a broken and dark world. From over 800 miles away, Paul told the church at Philippi, don't stop doing the work just because I'm not with you. From over 800 miles away, Paul was willing to send Timothy back to report to them and get a report. From over 800 miles away, he was willing to send Epaphroditus back so that Epaphroditus could serve as an encouragement to them and them to he. From over 800 miles away, Paul was communicating to the church at Philippi that God works in us to work through us, to accomplish his grand purpose because of his great love for us and because he always, always, always desires what is best for us. Rome, where Paul was imprisoned, is approximately 4,845 miles away from Franklin, Indiana. And Philippians was written, give or take, about 1,963 years ago. But I believe the message that Paul wrote transcends the distance and transcends the time to tell us that we are not merely a means to an end for God. So what can you do to continue to work out your salvation, to continue to show the results of what God has done for you that you could never do for yourself, and to then be a light to those around you in a dark and deeply broken world? Let me pray for you this morning. Dear God, thank you for today. Thank you for this incredibly powerful part of Paul's letter to the church at Philippi, written from a Roman imprisonment over almost 5,000 miles from where we are here today, and almost 2,000 years ago. But a message that transcends time and distance, that we are anything but a means to an end for you. We are people who you love so deeply that you were willing to send your son to die on a cross to fix the problem and the brokenness of our sin. God, thank you for loving us this much, and help each and every one of us to determine what we can do to continue to show the results of that salvation to a dark and deeply broken world. In Jesus' name, amen.